This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Bear Boat Alaska, a pure DIY hunting game with one of their 37-foot adventure yachts. You and five of your friends can hunt, fish, set crab pots, shrimp pots, and take DIY to the next level. Bear Boat Alaska is locally owned by a Ketchikan resident who lives here year-round. Call Larry at 907-617-4542 or go to bearboatalaska.com. That's B-A-R-E. boatalaska.com and tell Larry you heard about it on this podcast. Welcome back to the podcast. My guest today is Joseph Jackson, author of It's Only Fly Fishing, which was released earlier this month. He's been in Alaska Magazine, Fly Fish Journal, The Drake, all the big ones. Thanks for being on here, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jeff. I appreciate it. I've been a fan of your podcast for a while now, and it's kind of surreal to be on it. So thanks for having me.
Surreal. That's funny to hear that said. You just kind of write the words, right? You don't really know who's reading them and what they think of it. So few people write letters, or you get really no feedback or correspondence. You get the check for the piece, but you don't really know if people hated it, if they flipped the next page or what. So I appreciate hearing that.
Exactly. Yeah. Writers kind of operate in the dark, it seems like, most of the time.
So how'd you get your start in writing? Did you journalism major, minor, or just write stories?
Good question. Yeah. So I kind of just got into it, you know, on a personal level, Jeff. My original degree was in wildlife biology, and it was actually kind of when I was working through my undergrad that I started writing trapping articles, like fur trapping. And I realized, you know, people would publish this and sometimes pay me for it. And I thought that was pretty cool. Cause I could do the things I love and then come back and write about it and, you know, get some readership. So that started happening with, fly fishing. I'm starting to do a little more like history based and, upland bird hunting, articles around those things. So yeah, just kind of fell into it, stuff that I love doing, and then reflecting on that through writing.
How did you deal with the, obviously, I'm sure that you had some rejection along the way. No one just sends out their first article and is published. And if that does happen, there's some lean times in between. But how did you handle the initial steps in the writing?
Yeah. So I guess I kind of had a pretty cushy start because I was writing for a lot of really super niche trapping magazines. And they're wanting to take, you know, whatever they can get, right? Mm-hmm. So I was, you know, this 18, 19-year-old writer that was probably not producing very good stuff, but, you know, they wanted it. And so it gave me some confidence boost right off the bat. But yeah, definitely once I started trying for the bigger magazines, it was a lot of rejection. But I kind of told myself, you know, if I'm not getting rejected, I'm not putting myself out there enough.
Right.
So in fact, and you know, other writers do this too, like Stephen King has stories that, you know, having a nail in the wall and just, you know, putting rejection letter after rejection letter on it. And I was kind of the same way. And I was almost a badge of pride, to see how many rejection letters I could get. Cause I figure law of averages, you know, you get 100 rejections, you're bound to get at least one positive response. So.
Yeah. I still have a rejection letter from Field and Stream, and now you can't even find who you can submit to. There's no like an email for submissions, and
yeah,
those smaller magazines, and I don't even like calling them smaller magazines because they're so important for people. They're so willing to help people out. They'll take submissions, they'll pay you on time, which is super nice. You'd be amazed at how many people that, you know, that aren't writers, they'd be amazed by how long it takes payments to come out, and how some magazines end up being just like an advertisement type thing. And it's mostly about the advertisements. They don't really care much about the writers. That's not like a woe is us or poor us or anything like that, but it is interesting to see the different models and how certain magazines value writers. And then it makes sense that really good writers gravitate to those sort of magazines. It's a lot of fun too, when you really want to put forth your best effort on that, because it's a big deal and you want to keep that connection.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it's nice. You rarely receive positive reader letters. You rarely know, you know, whether or not you're making an impact. But yeah, at least the magazines that I've kind of fallen into writing for, they do a good job of making you feel valued. So
when you're writing a story, do you sit down afterwards and just kind of try to type it out? Do you wait for inspiration, or how do you, that post fishing trip marinade or hunting trip marinade, how does that go?
So I try and really sit down and get after it as soon as I can, you know, before the random thoughts that you have during fishing or hunting trips sort of leave your brain. And I also try and combat that by carrying a notebook with me basically wherever I go. So if it's in the field, it's a write in the rain. And, you know, if I have thoughts, I'll jot them down quickly. And then when I get home, I'll put those all in like a Google Doc or something. That way I can work on it from any device. And I'll just start typing, you know, and as you're, you know, living through a fishing or a hunting trip, you kind of, not all the time, but often I kind of can sense the narrative structure that I'm going to take. You know, I think of the important things that have popped up, and I'll try and follow that. But then I try and keep myself as open as I can to, you know, improvisation, letting the story take me where it's going to take me. And I don't always know that. So, but yeah, as soon as I can, trying to translate my notes. Hopefully they're legible, you know, in the field. But yeah, trying to translate those as fast as I can.
it's kind of a double-edged sword. Sometimes I'm out there and I'm thinking about the story too early. I'm already writing it in my head and I'm not finished with it yet. You know, I sometimes it's like, this is going to be a tragedy, and I hate where this column's going to have to go because it's going to be about how, you know, the fish didn't show up, the deer didn't show up, the whatever. And then you can almost like take yourself down a hole that you don't need to be in, and that's going to be the self-fulfilling prophecy. But other times it's, you just kind of push that away and say, no, let's play the whole thing out here. We're only in act two. Let's just let this thing develop and then push those thoughts away and really enjoy the whole experience and then get home and then make some sort of sense out of it.
Yeah, that's a good point too, Jeff, because I know, at least in my personal experience, I feel like the stories that I just kind of let happen and then reflect on them later, those end up being better than the ones that I try and, you know, almost script.
Early on in the writing and hunting too, it's you have to decide what hunting or fishing is going to be to you, like how you're going to define it. Is it going to be just you know, they talk about the different stages of it and different phases. And then also when you start to create content from it, you also have to decide what you want that to be as well. So it's like this personal philosophy. Fly fishing is going to be an escape, and then I will also write about it. It's going to be a fun thing that I do. Or is fly fishing going to be a money-making means, and is it going to be my path or my way of notoriety, in which case it's less about fishing and more about kind of feeding the ego. How do you define what fishing is to you, and also your writing in this space? Do you hope to one day be a legend in the writing, or how do you deal with expectation in your definition?
That's a thinker there. In
Yeah, I
terms
kind of dropped
of,
that one in. That's a heater. That is a
yeah,
Friday
that is a heater.
afternoon heater.
No, that's great. I appreciate it. So in terms of like what fly fishing means to me, I wrote this whole book, you know, It's Only Fishing, about that, and I still have no idea what fly fishing is to me. You know, I know elements of what fly fishing is to me. And I mentioned it in the introduction to my book. It's like a return to childhood almost, because I don't know. I try and shed as much of my ego as I can when I go fishing. I just find that very freeing. You know, I'm getting better at letting the fishing journey take me where it's going to take me. Because in fishing, you can't plan for anything, right? It's up to the fish. It's up to Mother Nature. You know, call it what you will, but it's basically not up to me. And I guess that's a pretty salient part of what fly fishing is to me, is just surrendering to that. In terms of the writing, I would say I'd like to be known more as a writer than a fly fisherman. You know, I don't consider myself a particularly good fly fisherman. I think I'm reflective. That might be my saving grace, is, you know, I'm very detailed in journaling, you know, whether it's writing an essay or not. I'm writing what weather conditions were like, how the fish were behaving, like good spots, bad spots, that sort of thing. So I think just by sheer observation, I end up doing okay. But yeah, I would hope that my synthesis of my fishing trips is good enough to where, you know, I could someday be on the level of like the John Gearocks and the Ted Leesons and, you know, the vaunted fly fishing writers. I know that's a lot to hope for, but that's kind of the goal, right?
Yeah, I think pretending to be overly humble isn't necessarily reasonable because you have to have enough confidence in the space to know that you're worth, like, this is good enough to be submitted, this is good enough to be published, and this is good enough to get pay for it. It's work. It takes time. It takes effort. And so you should be paid for it. And if you just kind of hope, well, maybe just one reader. And if one reader is there, like, yeah, that's a nice thing to say. But then on the other side of that, when, you know, people just come in here and, oh, I'm going to be the next best thing. And I think it can come through in their writing. Some of the icons in fly fishing writing, it was like this subtle delivery of the art and the why of all of it. It wasn't some, you know, overt exercise in, you know, meme writing or something. Like, I want to write this perfect line that people are going to one day share. It's just being super honest and telling the story in such a good intellectual way. It was just fun. It's just fun to read, and it's great to read. And then you go back and you kind of lament the past or the loss of the past. You know, in the 50s and 60s, you know, the steelhead fishing and king's fishing in Alaska, and then, you know, the old school tarpon fishing in Florida, and it's just written so well. The craft is so good. And then now it's, you know, being true to yourself, telling your own story, not trying to be someone else, be your version, but, you know, be influenced by those other people. And I think it's super important to do that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's something I had to, you know, going sort of back to my writing beginnings, like as I started getting more into fly fishing writing and first of all, realizing that was a thing, because I definitely didn't read fly fishing literature growing up. Mm-hmm. And so when I discovered that, like in college, it was, you know, everything I wrote was like in the vein of Ted Leeson, John Gearock, Thomas McGuane. And then over time, you know, as you get more practiced, I kind of tried to take on my own voice because you're exactly right. Like those writers are well known and cherished because they just have a way of almost being invisible in their writing, but telling the story so well that it just comes off as totally honest. And then, you know, for someone to imitate that poorly, it just comes off as pretentious and, you know, nobody likes it. So trying to get past that point, I guess, and into my own style has been one of the hurdles that I've grappled with.
Yeah. Gearock's one of my favorites. You can reread his book over and over again, or whatever book it is, you can reread it over and over again. And you might have lines that are underlined in there and you know exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But just from the element of craft, if you're a writer and you're stuck and you just, how effortless it is for him to write that, which is encouraging because you don't have to overcomplicate it. Just tell the story. Just tell the story. But then also he'll word something so eloquently you think, dang, it would take me a page to try to just maybe get something, but it's just so perfect there in one sentence. So it's good to be reminded to tell your own story and let that tell the story. And then also just the amount of time he spent to get to that spot. And man, his books are great. And I love rereading them. And it's tough to think about the one day it's going to be the last book. And I try to cherish that now before he stops writing, because man, I could take one every other year forever.
Yeah, me too. I know the bookshelf to my right here is full of, I pride myself on having every one of John Gearock's books. And I'm definitely looking forward to the one that's coming out in March, I think it is.
Yeah. Do you ever feel that you get redundant? I get this sometimes. I write a column, and it seems sometimes that the same themes come up over and over again. I think, man, are people tired of hearing the same sort of thing? Because it is different, but it is the same. You know, a guy like Gearock, it's fly fishing. It's the same places. You can guess where he's going to be, but still it's just different enough. Do you ever kind of get into a rut and think, ah, this is redundant, or worry about it being tired?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I have my preferences in terms of like themes, you know, and even places that I fish too, you know, I tend to gravitate toward interior Alaska in my fishing, and then therefore, you know, settings and fish and techniques, those can all end up being the same. And I probably reuse lines. I don't know. I hope not, but you never know. And then, yeah, themes too. Like, I don't know. I usually take a hard look at the past and like my childhood whenever I write about fly fishing, you know, just going back to my origin sort of thing. And Yeah, I have to be careful and kind of remind myself, like, not everyone cares as much about your childhood as you do, you know? Like, make it relatable, like make it specific enough to be poignant, but don't overdo it, 'cause yeah, nobody cares at a certain point.
Yeah, I think there's if you can use it as a connector, and I think that's that thing that makes the difference between a podcast that's a conversation that has interest, and then writing about things that have interest versus it's people telling inside jokes on a podcast, which gets really boring because you're not there, and so it doesn't really make any sense. There's nothing to kind of grab onto. Same thing with reading. If it's just this, it's if it's all about you and it's all about, your impact, your past, your inside jokes, and there's no connecting element, then it ends up being kind of boring. So, and then also, again, not applying too much weight to something that happened in the past. If it is instructive, if it was a key moment, then talking about that, and I think that resonates a lot with people, because people are interested in other people's journeys and how people got to different places, and I think that'll always be compelling. But yeah, it's tough to know when is too much and what is relevant and what is not.
Yeah, that's funny you mentioned that, because my book in my introduction, I mentioned like my goal with this was to write an essay for every fishing trip I took in 2020. Most of them have been cut out because they were complete slop, you know, and that's the total truth. Like, I think there are 16 or 18 chapters in the book, and I bet you I wrote, I don't know, 30 or so. I wrote start to finish. I thought they were good. I edited them with the intent of putting them in the book, and then I just realized I'm either being redundant, like this is just no good, I don't know what I was thinking here, or readers are just going to get bored, like you said. So yeah, sometimes you have to come down with that butcher knife and chop what you like.
That's the most important part. I tell my journalism students, like, write 1,000 words and then cut down to 600 or 500. Editing is where it all happens. If there's, it's you can't just write start to finish. Sometimes you'll have a great lead, like, oh, this is definitely how I'm going to start. But sometimes you fall in love with something that ends up not matching or end up not being good, and you just gotta open up another document and save the cut stuff in there to hold on to it and probably never use it. But yeah, the editing part is so vital. So I started 2020 with a similar project. My goal was to write 5,000 words per month to just give people an idea of what Alaska is like year round. People come up here and they'll go on their little pilgrimage to whatever river, and they'll or go hunt caribou or whatever. They'll tell that story when they get back home in those magazines and whatnot. So I wanted to give people a year round look of what it's like here. But of course, March happens and things get I think you referred to it as things going sideways. How did that go for you? Just when March started to happen, and like what your plan was, and then how things started to happen. How was that?
Yeah, I mean, really, 2020 wasn't super jarring to me, at least in terms of fishing. My book strays into like, the struggles of young adulthood, because on the side, like, I was transitioning from a salaried job in video production to then, interning to be a secondary teacher. So that part was definitely that threw that had a lot of wrenches that were thrown into the plan. But I tend to be more of like a road system dirt bag fisherman. So like I could still do all that stuff being in Alaska year round, I could still do that stuff. I had some plans actually to come down to Juneau, where my wife was working at the time, and fly fish for some coastal cutthroats in May. That's one of my favorite species, but being in well, South Central Alaska now, I don't have that opportunity. So that was kind of a bummer, but then, just kind of made the best of it. Made the best of teleworking. I think I have a line in my book that teleworking is just a perfect excuse to fly fish on work days, or weekdays. And so yeah, actually it turned out to be a pretty great season for me, just 'cause I was able to fish a lot, and then, I had, I guess, the creative space to think about that and reflect on it and ultimately write about it.
Did you second guess teaching because you saw what everything was going on with the masks and the, is it Zoom and all that stuff? Were you like, eh, maybe not. Maybe I don't want to get into this profession.
I did. That was the wackiest teaching internship I think ever. Anyone who was doing their student teaching in 2020 will probably say the same, because 75% of our year was spent on Zoom, which of course meant everything I'd learned the past 3 years about managing a classroom and teaching
Yeah.
face to face just went out the window, you know. And I had, we went back at the beginning of fourth quarter, so I had like 4 or 5 weeks of in-person teaching before, you know, it was summer, and then the next year I was going to be looking for a full-time teaching gig, you know.
Yeah, it was such a contradiction or such a weird juxtaposition or whatever, just to know that you're built for it. If you live in Alaska, chances are that you're built for the pandemic type thing as far as what your hobbies are. You're like, a lot of the things are outside. You don't live in Alaska for the indoor life. Some people obviously can't choose where they live, but by and large, a lot of people, the things that you do to just live your everyday life are things that ended up being really good and helpful and healthy for COVID. So your life outside of your job, okay, I'm good. I like this. This is perfect. I'm glad I'm here. I have these habits. I don't have to convince myself to start this new habit of hiking, fishing, or whatever. But yeah, the school part was, man, it was bizarre. But living here, it was nice because kids also had those same sort of habits and hobbies. And on the days that we were at 50% capacity and we didn't have school on Friday, you know, kids would go out hunting. And I just thought, man, that's awesome. They wouldn't show up to office
That
hours,
is.
but I'm thinking that's what a great healthy way that they can get through this here. And had they lived down south, you know, you're stuck in an urban setting. You're locked inside and you're cranking your neck looking at computer screen or video games, or you're on your phone, and what else are you supposed to do? So it was so nice to be able to have or know that the kids can take care of themselves that way. And then when we got back together, you know, it felt like, you know, these smaller communities are able to kind of get through things together. And I think that, actually, I know that last year's senior class, we kind of went through COVID together, and I've never felt closer to a class. It just felt like we all got through stuff together. None of us wanted to wear masks. It was weird. It was just crazy. But we did what we needed to do. We got through it, and it made me really happy that I had the job that I did, because there were some other jobs that were exposed as super bad, and some people probably would never want to be a teacher, but it actually reinforced that I do like this job.
Yeah, there's like some camaraderie in the misery, right? Yeah, no, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I mean, being in Anchorage, more of an urban setting, I mean, as Alaska goes, right? Some students were definitely shut-ins, but I think for the most part, you know, you hit the nail on the head. Like, they're able to get out, they're able to hike, they're able to, you know, get out and kind of care for themselves, you know, through the outdoors. And yeah, I think that helped Alaskans a lot.
When you were doing editing, did you go back? I haven't read all the book, but when you went back to edit, you had more time to maybe look at some of the stuff you wrote regarding the virus. Were you tempted to edit? I know when I was looking at, because I went month by month, and so when I looked at what I wrote in April, when I'm editing in December, I'm thinking, oh man, I could totally change this. I'm a little bit off, or I don't like what I wrote. But I try to do each month individually. And so when I was done with the month, I edited the month, and that was it, so that I wasn't editing with the benefit of hindsight. And oh boy, but it was tempting though. Did you want to cut more stuff? Did you want to change stuff? Like, gosh, I'm just so tired of reading this stuff. How did you deal with that?
Well, to be honest, I didn't include a whole lot about the virus. I mean, I mentioned it early on. I was kind of like, you know, this is the background on the year in which all this fishing is taking place, you know. But I don't know. I kind of put it in the reader's hands. Maybe that's lazy as a writer, but I was like, you all have your own versions of what, you know, sideways meant in terms of the pandemic. Like, what follows is what it meant for me. It meant a lot of fishing, like a lot of things up in the air, just because I don't know, you know, job wise, how this year is going to look, if I'm going to land a teaching job, like how that's going to work out. So yeah, I never felt compelled to like go back and adjust what I said, just because I don't know. I guess I said what I wanted to say at the time and figured it was best to just leave it at that. Just shut up at that point, you know?
That's good. I think by the time 2021 or halfway through the year started to roll around, people were so tired of it anyway. I thought, man, that I only mentioned it in the last little bit of each chapter because I thought, hey, I'm going to write about what this is for no other reason than you know, keeping a time capsule of it.
Yeah.
But man, it ended up
Yeah.
being just Oh, yeah, it just great, man. So much, man. So much, so much.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny you mentioned that. I think I used like the phrases toilet paper shortage, social distancing. I think I made it through the book without using the term unprecedented, because I
Oh,
know everyone
gosh.
was so sick of the term
Oh.
unprecedented. I was like, if I put it in this book, people are going to shut down. I'm not using that word.
I was talking with a colleague yesterday about like educational jargon that you just, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. And they used
Yeah.
to be like good terms that had meaning and people would use them. But then once the like educational consultants and politicians get a hold of them, they're just ruined
Oh,
because then there's just
yeah.
no meaning anymore. It's just buzzwords and oh man, it just makes you sick. But
Yeah, we got a lot of buzzwords during the pandemic.
teaching is great. I love teaching. You got the hours in the classroom with the kids, but of course, you know, it's the administrative stuff. Like I really like my administrative team here. But just the other stuff, the extra stuff, the just
Yeah.
stuff, you know, and man, that stuff kind of wears you down a little bit. But the time and when you know kids are starting to get it, kids are understanding, and it's nice to like have a career that you feel purpose and value. And so it's not just whatever job that I have that I don't really like that I just tolerate so that I can go fishing or hunting. It's nice to have a career where you feel purpose and you feel that, you know, you're not, I can't wait for the day that I make enough money writing or that once my YouTube explodes, then I won't have to be a teacher
Yeah.
anymore. 'Cause then I think you kind of feel that you can sense that desperation that some people have that they want to make it because they hate their job. But you know, it's also with the writing and with everything else, I've realized I really, really like this job, and it's great to have the whole year be good. You know, summer's off is an amazing opportunity to, you know, kind of do that other life and do the fishing and everything.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's really nice to have a job that you don't want to escape.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and as a new teacher, this is, I guess, only my second year teaching. Yeah. So I'm finding that. I mean, sure, it's, yeah, super, super hard job, but also super rewarding. Like you don't get those moments of fulfillment every day, maybe not even every week, but when you do, it makes up for the past, however much time that you just felt kind of miserable or you felt like your teaching's not really landing. So yeah, I'm liking where I'm at, and yeah, it seems to work with my writing side gig pretty well.
Yeah.
So happy with that.
Did you have a teacher that maybe inspired you, or how did you get to teaching? A student asked me today if I always wanted to be a teacher. I said no. When I was a sophomore in high school, I said I will. Once I leave Alaska after I graduate, I'm never coming back, and I am never going to be a teacher. And now here I am. So,
Yeah.
what kind of got you to become a teacher?
Yeah. So when I was in Fairbanks at my, I just graduated college, and I was lucky enough to get a job as a video producer for the University of Alaska Fairbanks eCampus department. And so I just lucked into that, 'cause like I mentioned earlier, my degree was in wildlife. Like, it had nothing to do with video production, really. That was more of a hobby that I had been practicing for a while. So landed there, and of course eCampus specializes in delivering online courses. And I always thought, like, online courses are just a way to get a grade. Like, meaningful learning experiences don't happen online. Was kind of my way of thinking. But I saw what some of my colleagues were doing and what some of the professors were doing that I would help produce videos for, and I realized teaching can be pretty amazing if you know good pedagogy, and you are meaningful with your learning experiences. So or deliberate with your learning experiences, I should say. And I thought, well, I'll give this a try. I guess it was just that inspiration that really made me take the leap, and ended up enjoying it to the point where I thought, okay, this is going to be my, not really second career, but sort of. I never, like you, I never thought I'd be a teacher. So,
Yeah. It's nice. It's where all those cliche things are totally true.
yeah.
Where'd you grow up?
Oh, Wyoming.
We're at in Wyoming.
Yeah, southeast near the town of Torrington. You know where that's at? Like, right up against the Nebraska border, about an hour and a half north of Cheyenne, the capital.
My wife got her PhD at University of Wyoming, so I spent a lot of time the last couple summers
Okay.
fly fishing up in the Bighorns, and we went over to the Wind River Range. The Winds?
Oh,
Wind?
yeah.
It's the winds, but it's the snowies, right? I always screw that up. I actually was talking with my wife about this, and I always the nickname for those mountains I always got them wrong. But yeah, my a cousin of mine was actually working on a ranch up in Torrington.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I've
Funny,
never
small world.
been up there, but yeah, it's Wyoming's a cool state. They got some the people who know about where golden trout are very,
Oh, yeah.
very secretive. That is
Yeah.
a hot. There are some websites where you can go to and some information. I called a biologist to ask about some lakes that have been stocked, and he gave me some information. But still, it was if you were in the ballpark, he would then maybe fill in some gaps. But it wasn't like a,
Yeah.
hey, where can I catch them and how do I get there? It was, well, where do you want to go? What type of experience do you want to have? So you had to work for it. But do you miss anything about some of the fishing that you did down to there or the lifestyle down there?
I definitely do, yeah. And fishing actually not so much. I don't know. I'm kind of tied up with Alaska fly fishing now. I've kind of been ruined. Like,
Yeah.
yeah, fly fishing in Wyoming is great and all that, but I really didn't get into fly fishing too much until I came up here in 2014 for college. So this is kind of like my default for fly fishing. But in terms of other stuff, just like the landscape of Wyoming, like I'll never get that an affinity for that out of me. You know, I was just home for to visit my family for Thanksgiving and went bird hunting every day, which was amazing in late November. That's something I can't do in Alaska. You know, we're covered by 3 feet of snow. But yeah, just walking the pastures, like being able to see forever and the sunrises and sunsets there, it's just amazing. I do miss Wyoming a lot sometimes and the opportunities, but I don't know. Alaska and Wyoming are very similar states, I feel like. I don't know if it's collective mindset or, you know, just orientation toward the outdoors or just sort of self-sufficiency, but it was a fairly seamless transition for me coming from Wyoming to Fairbanks, Alaska. And now Anchorage. I mean, the whole city thing is still a little off-putting to me. Like I'll never get rid of that. Like I'm a rural boy at heart. I grew up in a town of 500 people, so
It is different being on the road system here in Southeast. It's a small town that's not connected. Down there, you know, you drive a
yeah.
couple hours, then you are somewhere. But man, if I do miss something about we have mouse fishing up here, which is total, so much fun.
Oh, amazing,
But
yeah.
just plopping down a hopper on one of those hot meadow streams is so, that's such a great experience. And then big old brown trout. I wouldn't, you know, I don't, not going to give up steelhead or anything like that for brown
Right,
trout, but
yeah.
you know, it's like, ah, gosh, there's other fish out there that are pretty sweet. Do you have a list of some places that you want to go? I know you're super excited and you have w way more water up there to fish than you could do in a couple lifetimes, but you know,
Yeah.
are you eyeing Patagonia or Christmas Island or Belize or anything like that?
Yeah, so I've been eyeing Slovenia and marble trout for a while, and actually my wife and I are headed there in late right as soon as school gets out, basically.
Nice.
So we're headed there. I've actually this past summer I spent like practicing for that trip just because it's like 6x, 7x tippet, you know, and I've never had to use 7x tippet in Alaska, you know,
Oh, yeah.
like practicing with those tiny tippets, like practicing Euro nymphing, like doing stuff without an indicator, like been practicing for that. Love to go to Scandinavia. I think that'd be sweet. I just got into spey fishing this past year, and I think that'd be awesome to spey fish for Atlantic salmon. I mean, whether it's Canada or Scandinavia for that matter. I think that'd be sweet. I guess North America wise, yeah, like Tierra del Fuego, again, like spey fishing for sea run browns, that would be amazing. I have a buddy who's done that a couple times, and just yeah, I can't. I probably annoy him with all my questions, you know. But and then yeah, I guess it would be pretty fun just to do like a road trip in Montana, Wyoming, you know, during the height of summer, and just do some cutthroat fishing, like get in the stream and just wander to your heart's content, you know.
Yeah, I did the Madison a couple of years ago. You have to go. I know everybody goes there, but you still got to go to there and some of those iconic rivers just to see them, just to see it, just to do it. Frying Pan River, of course, in Colorado. You know, it gets written about. You do it, and it's pretty fun. But
Yeah, that's cool. Those big name rivers, I know it is. You're like compelled to do it. It's kind of like the Kenai up here. If you come to Alaska, you gotta fish the Kenai.
Yeah, might as
So
well. Might as well.
might as well, yeah.
Yeah. So, what do you got for a closer here? Tell people where you can get the book. Anything else you got for advertisement pitches, things like that.
Okay, yeah. So you can get my book, It's Only Fishing, at my website, josephdjacksonwriter.com. Otherwise, if you just search the name, It's Only Fishing, it'll pop up on Amazon, Barnes Noble, Target, the typical online stores. I'm trying to get a good idea of like which bookstores in Alaska it's going to be at. I'm hoping it's going to be in Juneau, Anchorage, Fairbanks, but yeah, online. For those of you that aren't in those places, online is probably going to be your best bet. And yeah, I guess keep an eye out. I've got another book in the works, kind of similar, just essays on fly fishing. I've started working in more bird hunting and small game hunting in general, I guess. So that should be hopefully coming out in, I don't know, a year or two. Hard to say about the publishing world, but
Oh man,
yeah, that's the plan.
it's crazy. That's a whole nother thing. Do you have social media things like that where people can kind of follow the progress?
Oh yeah, social media. So Instagram, I'm save a worm, fish a fly, save a worm, and then underscore fish a fly. I post updates on there, and yeah, there's a link to my website. And yeah, Instagram's really the only one I do or spend time on. I don't know. I get overwhelmed by all the options out there these days, so I try and keep it simple.
Yeah, there's no need to go to TikTok. Z
No,
zero,
no
zero need.
TikTok.
And
Yeah.
then you're not 16, so you or 17, so
Right, no.
stay away from Snapchat too. But
Yeah.
cool, man. Well, it's great meet you. Thanks for chatting. Really appreciate it. Good luck with the book, and yeah, man, we'll be in touch.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for having me, Jeff. Like I said, it's pretty cool feeling to be on this podcast, having listened to it so often. I feel like you capture the authentic Alaska. So I hope I helped you continue that.
No, that's great. Thanks. I really appreciate that. It takes 300 some episodes, but I think I'm finally starting to hit my stride a little bit.
Sweet. Yeah. Well, it's excellent. Keep the content coming, and thanks again.
Cool. Thanks.